The John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
I'm your host, John Age, and you found it. You are here. You're in the Anomic Age. It's a pleasure to be back with you once again today. You're in the driver's seat on the main stage in the Anomic Age. So much to get into today with our guest, Mr. Clint Lawrence. He'll be with us in just a mere matter of seconds. But before we get into that, please check out AnomicAge.com. So much good stuff there. The information breakdown segments, I've been delinquent on that past few weeks. I promise you I will get to it with any luck later this evening. We'll start doing the information breakdown segments on more of a regular basis. You can also download the iTunes and the Android, and you can just download the podcast also directly from AnomicAge.com. You can check out all the show links, all the guest information, the video, the audio. It's free for you, but not free for me. So if you are so inclined, hit that donate button, the Patreon and or the PayPal. PayPal.me/AnomicAge and Patreon.com/AnomicAge as well. If you love the content, if you love the show, which I know many of you do, please, every little bit helps. You don't have to donate $200. You don't have to donate $50. You can donate a dollar. You can donate $5. It all helps because those bills keep on a-coming for all the server space, all the web stuff. When you get into this game, you don't really realize how much stuff it really takes to run this thing anywhere close to right. I know somebody out there is going, wait, you need to add more of that. I know, man. I do. I do need to have stickers, mugs, shirts, and so forth. I do need to have all kinds of new updates and modifications. But you know what it means. The Quan. So, won't belabor that point anymore. But if you do like what you have heard and are hearing and watching, hit the donate button, if you will. If you can. If you shall. But, no more of that. You stick around for just a mere matter of moments. We'll be joined by our guest on the other side. Stick around. It is my pleasure to welcome Mr. Clint Lawrence into the Anomic Age. Clint is a former Army infantry officer and paratrooper sent to Fort Leavenworth Military Prison in 2013 for ordering his paratroopers to defend themselves against the Taliban in Afghanistan. After 6 years of imprisonment, President Donald J. Trump reviewed the exculpatory evidence that was withheld by the corrupt Obama-era prosecutors and issued a full pardon. Clint is a graduate of the University of North Texas and an ardent conservative supporter of President Trump. Clint was invited to share the stage with the president in Miami on Pearl Harbor Day 2019, where Clint spoke about the importance of bold American leadership. Clint, it's definitely a pleasure to speak with you. I'm so happy to speak with you, actually.
Thank you for having me.
You bet, man. The last time I spoke was with your mother and your attorney, which was a little over a year ago. It was a pleasure to speak with them. It was great. I'm so happy I got that opportunity. I spoke with your mother on the phone for a length of time way before we even got the show rolling. But I got to say, it's great to see you and speak to you sort of in person. Over the internet's kind of pretty close these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a wild ride for the last, it's been 10 months, almost 11 months since I got out of Fort Leavenworth. It's been like, just like a sprint. It's been crazy.
Yeah, I got to say, I can't even imagine. I don't think most of the listeners can even imagine the kind of ordeal that you've been through. And I suppose it's kind of cliche to say we start at the beginning, but I mean, this could be one of those kind of rudimentary points. What got you in the military? What was that turning point for you, I suppose, you know, after high school and graduation and whatnot? What was that turning point that said, yeah, you know, I want to sign up. I want to do this. Because it says, you know, graduate from University of North Texas. So,
So, you know, when I was growing up, I grew up in rural Oklahoma and North Texas. And I wanted to be a state trooper, actually. And, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing happened and we were 2 hours away from that when that happened. So that hit us really close, really hard. And, you know, so, you know, after that happened, I sort of solidified my understanding of wanting to and my knowing that I wanted to be a public servant somehow. And then, you know, it kind of introduced terrorism into my young life because, you know, we used to not think about terrorism in the United States very, very much. But, you know, we definitely do now. But and then 9/11 happened and I was in high school when that happened. And I sort of knew at that point that I needed to forego being a police officer and go into the military and do my part.
Certainly. I mean, the terrorism angle is really a big part of this whole hub, I would say. I mean, I'm kind of like you, not too far off the demographic. I think I was in middle school when the first Gulf War sort of rumblings began, and that was all new for me as well. I was kind of like, what's this? You know, I knew of history from my grandparents from World War II and that whole generation, but, you know, kind of to your point, it was kind of hard for a lot of us, I think, to wrap our heads around, like, terrorism on domestic soil, you know, and 9/11. And, of course, the Oklahoma City bombing definitely brought that full circle to a lot of us.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we think, you know, because there's so much separation between, you know, the rest of the world and all the terrible parts of the world and us, we think that, you know, we're sort of immune to that kind of stuff. So I think it's – and one of the frustrations for me and a lot of folks is that, you know, a lot of times Americans – we only care about what happens in our country. And, you know, you see this with the riots across the country right now and all this stuff. And people, you know, Americans seem to have a one track mind. And I think that's unfortunate because there's a lot of stuff going on in the world that if you pay attention to it, it's very scary and it's very threatening to our standing and to our troops, you know, in the various different places they are and stuff. And, you know, I think it's something that we all should pay attention to, terrorism and the threats of China and Russia and Iran, all of these things I think are very important, but we seem to only care about, you know, burning down our own cities. So it's something that is certainly a source of frustration for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think Americans have a very myopic mindset. You know, I always kind of liken it to just taking not even a military plane or anything, just taking like a flight somewhere. You know, you get up in the air a little bit and you realize, oh man, like I'm this little dot right here. And if I fly just 30 minutes over there, you know, it's a totally different ballgame in some perspectives. And I can't even imagine flying to a totally different world, almost literally, when you're looking at going to Afghanistan and places like that. Is that the primary place you were while you were stationed overseas?
Yeah, I spent some time in Iraq. It was supposed to be 12 months. It turned into 15 months. It was during the 2007 surge, during the whole Bergdahl incident. And I, came back and went back to college and, then went in as an officer and went back in as an officer and then went to Afghanistan. And, you know, I spent my first couple of years in the Army in Korea. So I spent a lot of my time in the military overseas, and sort of, you know, getting to know the rest of the world. And, I think that sort of shaped my perspective of the world.
Yeah. I mean, if you could sort of paint the listeners and viewers of this a little bit of a picture of that sort of dichotomy between, you know, I hate to say cushy, but very cushy, nice life here in America. And, you know, like I was saying, you get on a flight for a few hours and you're in a third world immersion. And we're not talking about, we took a cruise to Cancun and we got off the boat for a couple of hours. Like, this is a totally different ball game.
Yeah. I think, you know, in America, we take our freedoms for granted and, you know, just that we can have a free and fair election coming up in a couple of weeks and You know, we don't have to worry about when we go to the polls, somebody coming up and detonating their car and blowing up our car just to blow up the polling place. But there are many, many different countries and many different places in the world where that happens. And I think that's something that we got to, you know, maintain our perspective on. And so, you know, right now there's kind of like a grim mood in the country with coronavirus and everything that's going on. But, you know, at the end of the day, we still live in the best country and the greatest country on the face of the earth. And I don't say that as a sort of, you know, I guess a cliche kind of remark. I say that having been to many other countries and serving in the military and, you know, being able to make that comparison. And so, I think it's very important that we realize that, you know, though we have it, difficult that sometimes it's hard sometimes for us, especially, you know, during a pandemic and everything. Most of the world has it worse, a lot worse than we do. And so I think it's good to, you know, think back and be grateful, for where we are. And somebody, there's a woman running for Congress in Florida, and she said something the other day that I think is just great. She said, being born in America is like winning a lottery. And, you know, it really is, because you really only appreciate that when you leave America and you do everything you can to come back.
Yeah. I mean, I've spoke with and been friends with a lot of folks who served overseas, and just those small things like drinking the water and a clean bathroom and sleeping without worrying about mortar fire and things like that. I mean, these are all just subtleties we don't even think about here in the States. It's wild.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, walking to the post office and checking your mail, or, you know, walking to the bank, or, you know, being able to go start your car in the morning and not have to worry about it blowing up, because you made somebody mad the day before, one of your neighbors or something. Those are the kind of things that we definitely take for granted, but, you know, it's sad, but in a lot of the world, it's like you said, it's like, it's a whole different, universe, and it's very different from, you know, Afghan kids, for instance. You know, when we're growing up, we play soccer and football and baseball and all this stuff. But in Afghanistan, when they're growing up, they throw rocks at each other for fun. And so it's very, very different. And, you know, it's a very different mindset from the very beginning for them. And so when we apply, the American rule of law mindset and the domestic rule of law mindset to, you know, how we would do things on Main Street America, when we try to export that and take that into places like Afghanistan and Vietnam, and we try to say, no, we want you to be like us, of course that's not going to take hold, because they've, you know, from the very beginning of their lives, they're very different people, human beings, than we are. And so, you know, of course, you know, what happened in my case, it's the kind of stuff that happens when you have that kind of incongruous, you know, nature of living, and really societies. American society is a whole different ballgame than Afghan society or Iraqi society. So, you know, one of the things about Americans, you know, and the American public in general is they have this mentality of over there. We don't have to deal with that because there are men and women who join the military and go deal with that for us. And, you know, America is a great place with, you know, a lot of support for veterans when we come back and stuff. But I think we really need to think about what we're doing when we deploy our military and when we send our sons and daughters over to these kinds of places. What is it that we're really doing? And, you know, I think I read somewhere recently that the only people who want war are those who have never been involved in it or have never been, you know, directly involved in it. And so I think that's very telling, and it's very important that we have a commander in chief, who understands that war is not a good thing. And that we need to keep our troops out of war. And President Trump is somebody that does that. And you know, there's been a lot of people here lately say that, our commander in chief, doesn't care about the military. And I would argue that when a commander in chief says he wants to bring and tries to and takes every effort he can to bring his troops home from war, I would argue that that means he cares. Because, you know, going to Dover Air Force Base and, you know, and greeting the troops as they come in flag-draped coffins is not something to be taken lightly. And I think it's very important that we have a president who understands the military and the sacrifices of the military. Because, you know, when you're making a decision to deploy men and women into harm's way, I think you need to keep that kind of stuff in mind. And President Trump does. And I think it's important that we acknowledge that.
Yeah. I mean, while you were talking, I couldn't help but think of Smedley Butler's work, War is a Racket, you know,
yeah.
And I just keep thinking of all these war hawks that have gotten us into all these conflicts for the last, I mean, we had a little bit of a break between Vietnam and things stirring up in the Middle East again, but not by much. And it seems
yep.
all too often the politicians are, yeah, let's go get them. You get them. You know, they're turning around like, you get them. Like, you don't see a lot of these folks out there.
Yeah, you're so right. And, you know, President Eisenhower was so right about this when he was a general and when he left the military. And one of the things he warned about was the military-industrial complex and how it can be a racket. And, you know, people like, you know, the former Vice President Dick Cheney, who is widely known to have profited from sending our troops into Iraq. You know, to me, it would make a difference if those people had sons and daughters themselves that were in the military that were going. Because I think the true measure of a leader is somebody that will, you know, like General Patton, before he crosses a river, he's going to go and test it out first, and he's going to come back with wet pants. And so I think that's something that's a true measure of a leader is to understand truly, you know, what you're sending your troops into is not something that you would not do yourself.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I couldn't help but, again, while you were talking, I was thinking of all the sort of propaganda that we see in the media so often nowadays. It just sort of legitimizes it and glamorizes and glorifies all this quite a bit, which is sort of a polar opposite to a lot of the stuff you were seeing. I always can't help but think of Rod Serling, who was, I believe, a World War II veteran, if I'm not mistaken. It could have been Korea, but I'm pretty sure World War II. But so much of what he was doing in the Twilight Zone series and later on some of his other work was really trying to show people, you know, hold a mirror up to that combat and up to that war and say, hey, it's not, you know, John Wayne coming over the hill. It's far darker than that. It's not everybody comes home and rah, rah, rah. It's a lot of folks coming home, like you mentioned, with that draped coffin and coming back to family members and loved ones that'll never be the same. So that's a part I think as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, the effect that, you know, sending troops into war has on the human race is profound, and it's like ripple effects in a pond. It never stops. And you know, you have we have 22 suicides in the United States every single day, but of veterans who have come back, you know, and a lot of them are from Vietnam, and a lot of them are from recent conflicts, but you know, I've experienced that myself. It's you know, like when you get out of the military and you transition into being a civilian, it's like you exist as a completely different human being than you did when you were in the military. Living as a civilian and living as a member of the military, they're two different ways of life. So that's why it's so difficult for one to transition over, you know, out of the military. And that's why you have so much mental health, you know, really, it's really a tragedy, but you have so many, you know, of these mental health issues, coming out of that is because you go from living, right next to, you know, to your left and to your right, you're living right next to men and women who have been through exactly what you've been through. They've seen the things you've seen and they understand. And you don't even necessarily need to talk about it with them, but you know that you have somebody there. And then you move into a community when you become a civilian you move into a community where you may be the only person who has seen what you've seen and done what you've done. And so you don't, you know your community is supportive, but you don't have that common ground. You don't have that level of understanding. And, you know, to make matters worse, you have people on the left who are just doing whatever they can to hate everything about the military and about law enforcement. So, you know, it makes life very complicated. But I think it's very important that we have the right commander in chief, because it's important that we don't get ourselves into any more wars, because of the effects that it has on our society. You know, there are, when a soldier dies or a service member dies in combat, you know, sometimes they leave behind half a dozen kids and a wife, and then they've got mother, a father, brothers, sisters. There's all of these different, you know, rings of you know, concentric circles, really, of effect that really continues to hurt our society. And I think it's sad that we see this stuff, but it really comes down to the big decisions that are made in the White House. And that is, well, do we send our troops to war or do we not? And I think it's important, you know, President Trump just recently tweeted that he wanted to bring our troops home by Christmas. And I was on Fox and Friends a couple of weekends ago and they asked me about that. And my response was the same as it is now. And that is, if a president really cares about his troops, he does not send them to war. And he sends them to war as an absolute last result. And so President Trump understands that. And I think it's important that we acknowledge that.
Yeah, I would definitely say we need to bring the troops home. I've been saying that for decades. I feel like now I'm like, why are we here again? I mean, and this may be outside of your field here, but I keep sort of wondering, you know, what is causing, and I know you know from experience firsthand, but, and I'm being delicate here because I'm not trying to sound like some sort of wise guy, but I feel like there's so much post-traumatic stress and so much of that we're seeing in today's society. And I kind of got to wonder if it's not because, and there is no righteous war probably, but I kind of feel like everything we've been doing in the Middle East for a few decades now is not a very righteous conflict. You know, we could look back at World War One and Pearl Harbor and even Vietnam and say, okay, well, this or that instigated us and got us into that conflict and so forth. But for better or worse, I feel like the folks that were in those conflicts, probably to a lesser extent, Vietnam, they felt like they were righteously defending the nation. And I feel, or at least wonder, if a lot of the folks over there now are kind of thinking the same thing I am. And a lot of folks in the States are going like, why are we here again? I don't know if you can speak to that or not, or I'm just throwing out a lot of stuff, but.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, to a certain extent, we needed to go to Afghanistan to send a message to all of the people, you know, in the world who subscribe to terrorism, that the United States would not accept an attack on our homeland and that we would respond with military force. So I think we needed to go over there and send that message. I do not think we still need to be there 20 years later almost. You know, I didn't agree with going into Iraq, but I did join the military to support it because my country was doing it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to your question, we don't join the military to go and defend someone else's country. We join because our military is involved. Our country is at war and our country is involved in something. And we know that we need to do our part. And we know that, you know, by joining, we're going to be we're going to have the opportunity to serve alongside men and women that, you know, the best and brightest men and women and that this country has to offer are in the military or have been in the military at some point. And I will always stand by that. We have a wonderful military, very talented. And so, you know, we join because of that brotherhood and because of the sense of duty. You know, whether you serve 2 years or 4 years or whatever, I think that's the reason why most people join. But, you know, like you said, you know, in terms of righteous wars, it really is demeaning when you're in Afghanistan and like I was in 2012 and your own president, President Obama, does not support the war that he's ordered you to go to. And so, you know, it's sort of like going up to Burger King and ordering a Whopper and then, looking at it and with disdain and saying, you know, I really didn't want a Whopper. You know, this is a Whopper, but I didn't want it, you know, and it's just, this is a ridiculous Whopper. So at the end of the day, you know, the commander in chief has the ability to bring troops home from wars that somebody else started. And President Trump's doing that. And I really commend him for doing that. Because like you said, you know, in terms of a righteous war, it's very demeaning and it's very much a slap in the face whenever you know your own president does not support the military. And President Obama did not support the military. And we all knew it as we were fighting in a war that he ordered us to go into. We knew that he didn't support us. And that has a profound impact on the men and women in the military, because on the one hand, you feel like your country is engaged in this war and you need to be here for the men and women to your left and right. That's all there is to it. It's all about defending your fellow soldier, right? But on the other hand, if you know that your own government doesn't support you being there, then you're asking the question, then why are you putting my life at risk? Then why is my brother and my sister over here losing life and limb? And, you know, we had a soldier in our, an NCO in our battalion in Afghanistan that lost all of his limbs. He lost both legs and both arms. And, you know, he's doing incredibly well now. But the thing is, you know, when you're making those sacrifices, you want to know that it means something at the end of the day. And you want to know that, at the very least, if your country, does not support you, then the guy who sent you there supports you. And when we had president, we have the wrong president in office. We had President Obama. If we get a Biden, President Biden in office, we'll have the same problem. And I think it's incredibly important that we look at the ways that we're using, human life, human capital, and the ways that the Obama administration was disregarding the military was just so demoralizing. And, you know, that has a profound effect years later on all of those who served, who are still having problems with PTSD and all these, you know, this just really just it's an epidemic, really, of mental health problems coming out of the recent military veterans that have served in combat. And that has a huge part of it. You know, because it does something to a person to see their really good friend and brother or sister die in combat and know that it was for nothing. Now, if it would be a different story if, you know, China invaded North Carolina, then we would all rally and repel them very quickly, and they would very much regret it. We would hate it because we would lose people, but it would mean something more because we're defending our homeland. But when you have these troops that are in Afghanistan for almost 20 years now, and their own government doesn't support them under President Obama, it's demeaning and it's demoralizing and it's something that you never ever get over. And you know what happened with me, with my case specifically, it's something that is going to affect me and those that I love and who love me for the rest of my life. And that's because you had a commander in chief who did not understand how to employ his own military.
I think it sort of comes back to culture. Like you started talking in the very beginning, just the culture in Afghanistan and the Middle East is so, you know, polarizingly different than here in the States. And I could only assume that during the Obama regime, he intentionally toxified the culture within the military. I mean, I wasn't there like you were, but I can only see it as an outsider and only, you know, go off what you and others have said. Just how toxic the culture in the military must be when you're over there in a foreign land putting it all on the line and you know the commander-in-chief supposedly and the commander-in-chief is back there doing his, I think he did like about a year-long apology tour, going all around the world, just kissing everybody's ring, saying, oh, America's so terrible, I apologize. Or so, you know, I can only fathom what the soldiers are out there on the front lines are thinking when, you know, word gets back, oh, this is our commander-in-chief, he's apologizing, going all around the world, kissing rings, and we're out here, you know, sort of left hung out to dry. I can only imagine the toxic effects on the culture that must have.
Yeah, and when you when it's demonstrated time and time again that the commander-in-chief does not support his own military, and I say that, you know, I'm thinking of the Navy, the U.S. Navy patrol boat that got captured in international waters near Iran, and Iran claimed that it was in Iranian waters, captured it, and then we have international news where on the front page of every newspaper in the world, there are American sailors on their knees with their hands above their head at gunpoint. And what does President Obama do about that? Nothing. And, you know, I think, you know, Iran is more careful now because they know better to do that under President Trump, because he would strike back very hard. But, you know, I think it's very telling, you know, that image will never leave my mind for the rest of my life. I will never forget that image, that one incident, that one miscalculation of President Obama affected generations of men and women who serve in the military. And it's very important, you know, being the commander in chief, I would never want that job, but being the commander in chief has such a profound impact on, you know, the entire country and on such an intimate level. And I think we got to remember that on November 3rd, because, you know, regardless of what political beliefs you may have, we've still got men and women in harm's way. We're still at war, whether people want to remember that or not. We are still at war on two or three fronts. We have troops in over 100 different countries. There's only 195, 196 countries in the world, and we've got troops in over 100 of them. The world is a very, very dangerous place. And right now, as we speak, the People's Republic of China, the Communist China, I'll just say China, is competing to be the world's police and the world's superpower. And you know, there's a lot of people that say that the United States should not be the world police. And I think I understand what they're saying, and I agree with them to the extent that we should not send troops everywhere to fix everything. But we built the world. After World War II, the United States was the architect of the world. The world was in absolute shambles. And the United States was the only one strong enough to come in and clean it up and rebuild everything. And we did. And so we built a system, a world system, that we could have a huge amount of control over. And, you know, just using U.S. dollars as the, as really the standard for money in the world. And, you know, the United Nations, all these different things, that we have a huge amount of control over. It allows us to control, you know, the progress and the forward momentum of the world in terms of where we're going. And it allows American interests to always be right up front, and to be right there in everybody's periphery. And so I think we got to be real careful with, you know, with who we elect on November 3rd, because if we have another Barack Obama, if we have Joe Biden, then he's going to go on another apology tour and weaken the United States on the world stage. And there are many, many, many different wolves circling the campfire right now, waiting for it to get dimmer and waiting for it to get weaker because they want to attack. China is one of them. China, for the first time, a couple of years ago, for the first time, opened their first foreign military base. They opened it on the Horn of Africa, right down the road from a U.S. military base. China is expanding. They are expanding their world power and their world reach. They are building infrastructure in almost every third world country in the world. And if you don't think that they're not going to come back and collect on that, then, you know, you're very mistaken. China wants to be the next superpower, and they'll do anything they can to affect that. But there's one thing standing in their way, and that's the United States of America. And so I think we've got to be very aware of that, and we've got to be very careful with how we go forward. And, you know, like President Trump has said, and we have done the last 4 years, we cannot cower down to China just because they've got so many people. We've got to stand behind Taiwan. We've got to stand behind international law and enforce international law and international law of the sea and all this stuff. We've got to make sure that just because they're so big, we don't allow them to bully all of their neighbors. Because that, you know, the world that we built, and we are largely responsible for what China has become, because, you know, of our policies toward them. But, you know, I think we've got to be very careful with how we go forward in the world in terms of competition with China, because they're a huge threat. But in terms of how it plays out with our military, we've got to make sure that we back our military 100%. We can't under any circumstances allow that kind of nonsense that happened under the Obama administration to happen again, because it really demoralizes the military in such a profound way.
Yeah, I can't help but sort of think of it as ripples in a pond, what the Obama regime was allowed to do in this nation. But in regards to the military, I wonder how deep those psychological effects are. Because when I look back at past generations and, you know, my grandparents and parents and so forth, there was so much reverence for the military. And, you know, the progeny, if you will, of those soldiers was pretty gung-ho and into it. And, yeah, let's God, family, country, let's protect this nation and so forth. But I wonder what those long-term effects are when you look at, like you mentioned, the folks on the PT boat with their hands up on every headline news across the world. And then you got the veterans coming home going, you know, yeah, Obama's on this apology tour. We were out there getting it handed to us in X, Y, and Z in the middle of, you know, in the middle of the desert, so to speak. I'm cleaning up a little bit. But, you know, I wonder what those ramifications are. And I don't know if you might have a better sense of this, considering your close proximity to the military and folks in it. Are the folks in the military now, you think they've recovered from that 8-year disaster of Obama? Do you think they're sort of finally thinking we're back, we got a solid person backing us, we're red, white, and blue again, or what do you think?
No, you know, it's going to take longer than that. And here's why. Because in the military, in the Army specifically, I can speak to the Army, and I know this happens in other services. Once you become a general or an admiral, once you become a flag officer, and you've got to go before the United States Senate before you get promoted to the next level. At that point, you become a politician. And even though you're wearing a uniform, you are a politician and you're a bureaucrat. And I think it's very important that we acknowledge the level of influence that those people have on foreign policy, and they don't ever want to give up that influence. And so it's in their best interest to have the right person in the White House. And that's why you have so many of them fighting President Trump, even the ones that he appointed, his Secretary of Defense and Secretary of the Navy and the Army, and all that, even those people that he appointed are fighting him, because like you said earlier, and like General and President Eisenhower warned us of, you know, war is big money. It makes a lot of money for people, you know, like Halliburton and all these different companies. And there are people, once they get in the Pentagon and they get in this bureaucrat mess, they have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. And so to your question, you know, has the military recovered? I would say no, because you still have the same people in charge. The colonels that were, you know, in command during President Obama are now generals. And so, you know, I think it's very important to understand that there's a liberal elite that exists in the senior ranks of the military, and you will never get rid of that. I talk about that a lot in my book, Stolen Honor, about the liberal elite that's in the top echelons of the Pentagon. But, you know, will we ever recover from it? We have a good chance if we get we get the right people in the White House from, you know, for a couple of decades. But, you know, I think we're headed on a similar path forward, this progressive path forward. And I'm not sure if there's any stopping that. I think you can slow it down a little bit and do like an efficiency check every once in a while. But I'm not sure if there's any stopping it. There very much exists in the headshed of the Pentagon a class of people who have been there a long time and whose vested interest is very much on the same level with the people who are profiting off of the wars. Now, you know, I think there's a parallel that can be drawn between the military and police officers in this country. And I think that's a very important parallel because so on the streets of America right now, you have, you know, these people burning down our cities and toppling statues and stuff. And then you have the district attorneys and the mayors who are saying, wait a minute, don't burn anything else. We'll charge these police officers with the crime just to get them to stop. And so what that's doing, though, is it's having a negative effect on our criminal justice system, because that's turning our criminal justice system against American citizens who just so happen to be wearing a badge and a uniform and taking away their constitutional rights of due process. And it's taken away the protections afforded to them under the Constitution, all because we want to make the mobs happy. And the same kind of stuff was happening in the military justice system under President Obama that's happening in the streets of America right now. And so I think it's very important that we be careful not to change our criminal justice system into one that is a political tool to go after our political opponents with. Because that's what happens in Russia and China and all these terrible places, North Korea. If they don't like somebody, they just put them in jail or they kill them. And we can't ever become that. It's very, you know, one of the things that I do not agree with is when, you know, some of my friends and associates automatically jump to the whole if we don't like the governor of Michigan, then we should just lock her up. No. I mean, if she's committed a crime, then maybe, right? That, you know, she gets to go to a trial and all this stuff. But, you know, just because she disagrees with us politically doesn't mean that she goes to jail. That's the kind of crap that happens in Russia, and we don't want that. And many of those people who are saying that, they would be very adversely affected by that kind of thing, because our criminal justice system is very much infused with the liberal elite. And so, I think we got to be careful when we start saying stuff like that. But I think it's very important in terms of my own experience with the criminal justice system and the military and, you know, being a political prisoner for so long. I've seen what it does to a person when you use the criminal justice system as a political tool. And I've seen the profound effects that it has for the lasting effects that it has on many, many people. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why I fight right now to try and reform the military justice system specifically, because it, you know, a court needs to be about the law and it needs to be about the Constitution. I came to law school here. I'm in my first semester. And that's one of the reasons why I did is because, you know, I have a great deal of respect for the courts and the law and the rule of law, but not using it as a political tool. I think it's very important that we make that distinction. And so what they're doing in the military justice system is they're using it as a political tool. They started under President Obama by attacking people who they thought were sexual assault perpetrators. And they filled up military prisons with people who were not guilty. I'm not saying everybody there is not guilty, but there were many, there was a huge influx of people, military folks, who were sent to military prison after President Obama declared a war on sexual assault in the military. And so I think that it's important that we look at that kind of stuff and make sure that we, when we want to charge somebody with the crime, we do an elemental analysis to see if a crime exists. And you know, a political opponent, a political argument is not a crime. And that's what this whole country was founded upon, is the freedom to express ourselves and to freedom of speech and so on and so forth. And we've just got to be very careful with that kind of language.
I couldn't agree more. I think while you were talking, Joey Gibson's name kept coming up because I spoke with him a few weeks ago of Patriots Prayer, who does a lot of work in the Portland area. And he was sort of drawing a lot of these same parallels to the justice system here in the States. And I was thinking while you were speaking, the same thing could probably be said with the military justice system and that same sort of erosion of culture, that sort of commonality I keep coming back to. But I think the same thing that eroded a lot of the military culture, you're seeing now most likely doing the same in the police, because to couple with that, you're seeing a lot of veterans come back and be police officers or state troopers or sheriffs or whatnot. So I think they're coming back to this, to the States, and seeing the same thing, where especially in some of these big communist run cities like Chicago and Portland, Seattle, they're basically told hands off the communists destroying the city. So you got these police officers sworn to protect and serve, and they're out there saying, oh, well, we can't arrest these communists destroying the city because we might get arrested. We might get charged for something. And then the off chance that they do arrest somebody, they're usually bailed out and or time served or just drop charges or whatever within, you know, less than 24 hours. They can go back out and burn, rape, murder, and pillage some more. So I think we're definitely seeing some, sadly, a heck of a lot of commonality going on between those two things.
Yeah, it's sad. You know, if you – I mentioned I'm in law school here, and one of the things I'm learning is there are a lot of ridiculous laws out there. And if you want to charge somebody with a crime, especially on the federal side, you can probably find a way. So, for instance, it was once a crime to stop up a toilet in a national park. And that was a criminal offense. And, you know, so if I didn't like somebody because of their political views and I'm a prosecutor, then I can potentially charge them with something ridiculous like that if it met the standard, you know, for, you know, the elemental standard. And so, you know, I think what I mean to say there is, you know, if we want to change the criminal justice system into a political tool, it's going to change this country, and it'll change it fundamentally. President Obama said many times that he wanted to transform this country.
Oh yeah.
And I'm not sure that we understand, you know, exactly what he meant by that, but I think this might apply. And when you change, when you do what he did, and when he went all out and did an all out war on the military, and the military called everybody in the military a pervert, you know, there's a bunch of rapists in the military and all this stuff. And then when he, you know, when you're a war fighter and you go over, he, like, you know, what happened to me, he puts you in prison for killing the enemy. So, you know, I think we gotta ask ourselves as a country, are we going to be the type of country who, or a society who, when we run into a tragedy, when something terrible happens, are we going to turn to the person who's putting out the fire, or the person who is taking the bad guy to jail, or are we going to turn to the person who is bearing the heaviest burden, in this case, the police officers and the military, and are we going to turn on those people and blame it on them? So right now, that's what's happening, is you're seeing all this crime go up in New York City. I was just reading a report this morning. New York City's got a terrible crime rate right now, but yet they've got over 1,000 people, members of the NYPD have decided to retire this year. And the number is steadily increasing. What we're doing though, as a society, is we're looking to the police and we're saying, hey, you guys already have a lot on your shoulders, I know, but this is all your fault.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I think it's very important that we ask ourselves, do we want to be that type of country and that kind of society? Are we going to look at the people who bear the heaviest burden in our society and blame everything on them? And, you know, that's sort of what President Obama was doing with the military justice system. And that's what we're doing right now with in our cities, and our mayors and our district attorneys are allowing it to happen. And, you know, I think it's something we got to look at. You know, hyper-politicization of the criminal justice system, it ultimately erodes civil rights, and it changes our country fundamentally. And I think the founding fathers would not be happy with that.
Yeah, I think they'd be pretty upset for sure if they saw what was going on right about now. I mean, you mentioned, and I just call them communists. That's what I just call them as. But there's so many of these communists that are in these various hierarchical positions. If you want to look at district attorneys and attorney generals, and even like you were mentioning, there seems to be this sort of parasitic class in the upper echelons of the military. I'm thinking Pentagon and the like as well. What the heck happened? How the heck did these folks get there, and can we get them out? I know that's a huge ball of wax to throw at the wall, but what do you think?
Well, no, unfortunately. I think term limits are actually a really good option, starting with elected people. But in terms of what's happening in the military, it's all about careerism. It's incredibly sad to sit and listen to a conversation between senior military officers, and 90% of what they're talking about is their next promotion or their next opportunity to get promoted. It's just sad. It's sad to see, because back in the days of General Patton, they would be talking about how to win the war, how to better engage in tactics against the enemy, or some of the crazy things their troops are doing, or how to make the troops better and sharper. But now all they talk about is their next promotion and the bigger house that they're buying, and who's got the biggest house on the block, and who's got the nicest BMW. And I think that's sad. And to answer your question, no, I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. And I'm not sure that we can fix it other than to ensure that we have mechanisms in place like the Logan Act and all these different restrictive mechanism laws and regulations in place to make sure that we try to stamp down on this really elitism, this American royalty, and that is in the senior ranks of the bureaucracy. But it's not, Washington D.C. is a nasty town. It's always been nasty, but I'm not sure we're gonna fix that. I think the best that we can hope for is to just make sure that we don't send our troops into harm's way unnecessarily, and we stop getting into these hopeless wars, and we try to learn from our history a little bit. You would think that, when we were making the decisions and after 2001 and in 2003 when we decided to go into Iraq, when we were making these decisions, you would think that someone would have looked back to the lessons of Vietnam and said, "Hey, Mr. President, we've already been there and done that. Well, we can't win one of these kind of wars." But unfortunately, these parasites, all they see is their opportunity for their next promotion. So instead of defending the men and women who are going to actually be bleeding on the battlefield, they say, "Yeah, Mr. President, great idea. Let's talk about how we can do that." And I think their opinions would probably change if they had sons or daughters in the military themselves.
It seems to be this real disconnect from the battlefield. It seems to be all these folks making these decisions, kind of like we talked about earlier, just the folks way back. They're not even in the theater of war, so to speak. They're somewhere in D.C. or McLean, Virginia, or the like, calling all the shots, while the folks on the front lines are really paying the price for it, seems to me.
Yeah, I think you're right, 100%.
Well, definitely let's get into your book a little bit. I know we've sort of probably talked about a lot of different elements from it. Something I don't know if it's in there or not, but I was thinking about asking this anyway, is sort of outline the rules of engagement for folks a little bit, because I know that's a big piece, I believe anyway, of your story. And I think the average person out there sort of views these various theaters of war as just sort of a video game where you just go out there carte blanche and just start blasting, and you pull this out and that out, and it's all there. And it's not really like that.
No, not at all. it's nothing like you see on TV. Although the movie Lone Survivor, there are a couple of movies out there and a couple of books out there who really portray this very well. You know, the United States, when we rebuilt the world after World War II, you know, we insisted on making sure that nothing like what happened with the Third Reich ever happened again. So we insisted on making sure that the war crimes would not happen again, on especially on a large scale like that. And so when we went into the Geneva Conventions, we went into them with that in mind, in terms of let's regulate, let's all come together in the world and regulate how we're going to fight wars. And so the rules of engagement, they fluctuate depending on who's the president, but there's a baseline of, you know, you can't do that. So for instance, and this is one of the things we learned in the early days of even ROTC, you know, well, even basic training as an enlisted guy, if you get into a firefight with someone, with the enemy, and you shoot them and they're on the ground and, you know, they're bleeding, but they're not dead. And this is, I wholly agree with this. You cannot go up to that person after they're already on the ground and they're not a threat anymore, right? You've neutralized the threat. Even though they're not dead, you can't go up to them and kill them, right? Granted, they're still the enemy, right? And I wholly agree with that, because once someone stops being an immediate threat to you or to other brothers and sisters next to you, I think it's the humane thing to do to help them. And that's what we are about as a country, is we try to do the right thing in every situation, everywhere we go in the world. Now our enemy does not. We are fighting an enemy that would rather capture an American soldier and cut their eyeballs out and release them in the desert to wander around blind. Those are the kind of enemies that we are fighting, because they know that they're fighting a psychological war with us. But that does not mean that we ever change the way we do things. And so that's one of the things that frustrates me so much, is that people call me a war criminal and all these things, and that could not be further from the truth. And I completely believe in what we, and I talk about this in Stolen Honor a lot, I completely believe in what we, our values are as a country in terms of how we fight wars. We do it in a very honorable way. We only apply the amount of military force that's necessary to accomplish the mission. I think it's, you know, for instance, what happened in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, I think was necessary at that time to stop more people from dying. But you probably won't ever see anything like that again, hopefully not anymore anyway. Because, you know, the United States, we have a certain standard that we uphold. But in terms of the rules of engagement in Afghanistan, when you have the wrong president, they can add or take away from the restrictions on the fighting forces. And President Obama was so worried about what the president of Afghanistan thought about American troops, that he continued, and every time he changed the rules of engagement, he changed it in a way that would help the enemy. And so I think that's very important to think about, because we have an American president who is helping the enemy of the United States fight his own troops and kill his own troops. Now, that was not his intent, obviously. That's not his intent, but that's what he was doing. And when he was tying our hands behind our back and sending us into battle, that's what he was doing. So, you know, just for instance, and this is something that I write about in the book, is just for instance, if we're out on a foot patrol and a motorcycle or, you know, a car or a truck or anything comes up next to us and drops a grenade at our feet and blows a couple of us up and then runs off and drives off, and there's an American helicopter that sees everything, right? Say the helicopter tracks that car, they track that motorcycle or whatever, but then all of a sudden the motorcycle goes underneath trees and that helicopter cannot see him for 2 seconds. But he skirts it. He jumps out on the other side of the trees and he sees him. The helicopter sees him again. They know 100% that's the same motorcycle, right? That's the same people who just killed Americans. They know that 100% under the Obama administration. You could not kill that guy, or you could not engage that enemy after he went underneath those trees, because what the Obama administration said was, well, there could have been somebody else under those trees and it could have been him. And so, you know, those kind of things happened all the time. And there was absolutely no common sense. And one of the more surprising parts of my court martial was that there was a Fulbright colonel who went onto the stand and testified that 80% of the time that an American ground combat unit would ask for help from artillery or from aviation, 80% of the time they would be told no because they were worried about civilian casualties. And so here we have American, young 18, 19-year-old American men and women who are in trouble. They're calling for help. There's somebody picking up the phone and saying, I hear you. I know you need help, but President Obama will not let me help you. Now, what does that sound like? It sounds like Benghazi.
That's exactly what I was thinking. You know,
that kind of Benghazi was not an isolated incident. That kind of stuff happened in the Obama administration. The entire 8 years he was president, it happened in the military, and it had a profound effect on the military. And it's still having it. You know, you still have those people who believe that kind of crap and who you know ascribe to that kind of nonsense. And they're right now they're serving as generals in the military and admirals. And so I think it's very important that we really take a look at this. You know, we know that, you know, the United States is not a country that produces monsters, and we don't have a military of monsters that go around massacring, you know, like Nanking style. We don't have that. And we have a very honorable, very talented, very law and order, law abiding military. And so when we have a commander in chief like President Obama who does not get that, who doesn't know anything about the military, it really has an effect on the military itself as an institution and as, you know, on the ground level at the, you know, on the men and women who serve. And I think that's something very important to think about.
I just want to underscore what you were saying there. So the events that happened at Benghazi were not an isolated incident, folks. This was, correct me if I'm wrong, this seemed to be a very high profile incident where this happened, but not isolated. So this was going on, I won't say regularly, but more often than it should have during the Obama regime.
Yeah, the only reason why it gained so much attention is because the American ambassador was killed.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it became such a big deal. If there was a very, you know, it's like the Pat Tillman incident. The only reason why it gained so much attention is because it was Pat Tillman. He was a famous football player. Now, the real tragedy is that under the Obama administration, you know, random guys and gals from places like, you know, Pike Road, Alabama, the middle of, you know, rural America were being hung out to dry. And, you know, nobody ever cared about their stories. And, you know, that's sort of why I do what I do today. It's definitely why I'm in law school and it's definitely why I wrote the book is, because somebody's got to fight for those people. And I'm just, you know, a bit frustrated by the New York Times and the Washington Post just continue to try to impugn my character and attack me as a person and, use me as a tool, to basically say that President Trump made the wrong decision. And they do everything they can to try to make President Trump look bad, by attacking me. And so the sad part of that is a lot of those liberal elite, people in the military, currently in the military, they believe that nonsense. And so, you know, they're sort of being brainwashed by this nonsense, but, so, you know, I think it's the real tragedy is that those people think that there was actually a monster in their military among them. And, you know, that's just not the case, not at all.
Well, I don't know how much of this you want to get into, but I'm sure it's in the book nonetheless. From what I heard of your story from a previous interview with your mother and your attorney at the time, that you had gotten moved to a different area, that you weren't in charge of the same folks that you had been in charge with for a while, and you got moved into a very much a hotbed area with basically new folks that you weren't familiar with. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was only there for 72 hours when everything went down. And so those guys, you know, the ones that ultimately testified against me were the ones that I was there for 72 hours with. So one of the things that is often called out by the mainstream media is that I said to Sean Hannity that I didn't even know those guys. Yeah, I said that to Sean 7 years after the incident happened. And so, you know, I would challenge anyone to search their memory banks and go back. Now it's been 8 years. So go back 8 years ago and think of 40 people that they knew, that you knew for 3 days, right? Think of 40 people that you knew for 3 days and you never saw them again after that, and try to remember their names and try to remember their faces. You're not going to. It's not human nature to do that. And because you just meet so many people. And so, you know, I think it's interesting to bring forward, you know, it made the Army's case so much easier that they could go to those people who are strangers to me and say, hey, we're going to charge you with murder if you don't testify against him. And somebody's got to go down for this, so it may as well be the guy in charge. And so it made it easier for them. And, you know, they played right along. And the sad thing is, and this is something that'll resonate with police officers all around the world, and it has, is that there was zero evidence that anything was, you know, there was zero physical evidence of anything. The only evidence that they had, the only evidence that the government's prosecutors had was testimony. Was the guys that they flipped. And so if the guys would have been loyal and just shut up, then nothing would have happened. And we wouldn't be sitting here today. I'd probably still be in the Army somewhere. But that's not the case, because it's just not how things worked out.
So they basically coerced these folks to flip on you, if that's what I'm reading from this?
Yeah, and one of the things that was interesting about that is – there's a lot of talk about my entire platoon flipped on me. There were 40 guys in an infantry platoon, and an army platoon. There were 40 people in there. There were only 9 of them who testified against me, out of 40. And the other 31 said, I don't want anything to do with this. So, you know, but 9 of them, you know, some of them were actually charged with murder themselves. And, you know, once they flipped, you know, then they had a vested interest in continuing to maintain their story. So, you know, and to this day, the liberal media gives them a platform. And I think that's sad.
Yeah, I won't pretend that I've seen all the interviews and read every bit of the transcripts from this or anything, but I've seen a couple of the folks that came out, and I'm assuming some of these publications that you mentioned, I've seen a few of the videos where they came out and tried to disparage your credibility and your honor there. And I was just sort of, you know, I was taking it all in, and I was just kind of like, I don't get it. You know, I'm very sophomoric, I suppose, but why the heck are they doing this? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It, you know, at this point they have to defend their position.
Yeah.
And what other opportunities are they going to get to be on a documentary, on Stars, to be interviewed and be on national TV? What other opportunities are they going to get to be in the New York Times? What other opportunities are they going to get to be in the Washington Post? They're not, ever. So this is their one opportunity to get out there. And unfortunately, in the social media generation, everyone is trying to be famous, and everyone is all about their image. And, you know, this is part of that fallout is, and part of the effects that it has on our country as, you know, as a society and the world as a society, when you focus so much on your image. It means that you have to give up something. You can't have values and loyalty and honor and all these things and then also have all of that self-centered, self-loving, you know, putting self first. You can't have all those things, don't work together. So if you're going to have one, you're not going to have the other. And so I think that's sort of having its effect on, you know, on our society. But that's, you know, those guys who testified against me, they did it and they continue to do that because that's their position they've taken and they have to defend it. And, you know, the sad part is, and I write this in the book, is some of them have gone so far as to attack my supporters. And of course they do it from the anonymity of a, well, it's not anonymous. They do it from, you know, the internet. One of them actually even called in a bomb threat to one of my, supporters out in Idaho. So, you know, it's just it's sad to me that that's the state of things, but, the claim to fame for them, is something they don't want to let go of. And I think that's just unfortunate.
It's definitely quite unfortunate. During this whole trial, did they not contact the folks from your other platoon that you had actually served with for a long time?
They did, actually. And I was so humbled and happy and just so emotional about that, because they came to my defense and they came and got on the stand. They traveled to Fort Bragg and they said, no, this is a good guy. This is not whoever you're saying he is. And they defended me, very strongly. So I'm very happy with that. And still to this day, they defend me and I always love them for that, because they know me, they've served with me, and I know them. Now the guys that I've served with for 72 hours, they don't know me. To me, it makes a big deal. You know, perspective matters.
Yeah, I believe your mom touched on this a little in the previous interview, but since you're here, she was mentioning, and I am gathering it from the book as well, that this seemed to be quite an agenda from Obama to try to get somebody, basically, to make a point, for lack of a better term, you know, like, oh, look, there's someone doing this, and don't worry, we took care of it. That sort of mentality. I'm perhaps oversimplifying it a bit, but do you think that's what was going on?
You're 100% right. That's exactly what was going on. They were the Obama White House was trying to make the government in Kabul understand that the United States would be responsible and that we were a responsible partner. And so they took the opportunity to serve me up on a platter to basically say what you just said, to basically say, look, you know, we're a good partner. We put one of our own soldiers in prison, just to make you know that we're a good partner. And so I think that the Obama White House did not care of the effect that had on the rest of the military. And, you know, I had people I still have people to this day come up to me and say that they were serving in Afghanistan after I left, and that they all heard about my case and they all felt bad for me. It affected how they fought the war from that point on, because they were scared to fight because they heard about me going to prison and that scared them. They didn't want to fight. And so, you know, that's just another instance of President Obama giving the enemy more help, more assistance, you know, to the detriment of the American troop.
To connect dots here, I got to bring up the same thing again with the police. I think we're seeing those parallels just almost on par with this whole thing, where you got police out there now afraid to protect themselves, protect fellow officers, protect innocent people, because now they're worried about, okay, well, if I pull a trigger here and it's somehow deemed an incorrect shoot, then it's all over, which is so detrimental. I mean, you can speak to this far more than most, I'm sure. When you're in those situations, when your life quite literally is on the line, whether or not you pull this trigger or not, you can't really hesitate. You can't think, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't. You're dead. I mean, I'm trying not to go too hardcore here, but I mean, am I thinking and articulating the right things here from your perspective?
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, even animals have a breaking point. You can only beat a dog so much before he says, you know what, I'm out of here, and he runs away.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing as our police officers. If we keep beating them up as much as we have, and they keep going out there and just doing their job selflessly every day, at some point they're going to turn to each other and be like, why in the world are we doing this again? Then they're not making that much money. They really aren't.
That's true.
You know, so they're going to this job and they're getting beat up from the enemy and they're getting beat up from who's the people who supposedly have their back. And, you know, at some point they're just going to say, you know what, I'm done with this. And we're seeing that in New York City right now.
That's truth. Well, I hate to keep you on the line here forever. Is there anything we haven't touched on that you'd like to touch on or anything else you want to get off your chest before we get off the air?
No, I think we've about covered it all. I definitely appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about all this. There's a lot going on in the country right now. It's a lot that we need to be talking about, and it's a lot more than just whatever's going on social media.
Oh, indeed. Well, you're more than welcome to come back anytime. I was trying to steer it back towards your book because I feel like we could talk about the sad state of affairs for a long time, but anytime.
Yep. Thank you very much for having me.
You bet.
If your viewers want to get a copy of the book, it's at stolenhonorbook.com.
Indeed. I was going to say that before we closed out here. Is that the best way to get a hold of you and follow what you're doing and purchase the book and so forth?
Yep. Stolenhonorbook.com. I have a website for, you know, other stuff other than the book, other stuff I'm doing. It's at clintlawrence.com. So either one of those sites is, it links to all of my pages and stuff.
Well, that sounds good. Well, if you'll stick around for about 30 seconds, I'll wrap this up and talk to you for a moment off air.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. As I always say, I hate to be a broken record, but in case you missed all that, fear not. I'll have everything from today's interview, including those links he just mentioned, at anomicage.com. We'll have the video. We'll have the audio of all the guest links, as well as all the past guests as well. So check out anomicage.com. If you've not already done so, please do it now. So, in closing, you can't do everything, but you can absolutely do something. So just like Clint and all of our other past guests, please get out there and do your part and make that difference. Until next time, be safe out there, and I'll be seeing you sooner than later in the Anomic Age.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to anomicage.com. That's anomicage.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm not going to be able to do that.